Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Well, in the first segment of today's show, we're going to look at how we can get happy. Singer, actor, and star of the popular TV show Ugly Betty, Vanessa Williams, says this about my first guest. I know, she says, that if you listen closely to what Rob has to say and apply his principles to your life every day, you will achieve unprecedented success and unmatched happiness in your life. My guest is Robert Mack. He's the resident life coach for Miami Life Center, which is voted one of Travel and Leisure's top 25 health and wellness centers. Robert Mack has a degree in psychology as well as a master's in applied positive psychology. He's the author of Happiness from the Inside Out, The Art and Science of Fulfillment. Robert Mack, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
Pleased to have you here. And you certainly learned the hard way when we look for guests for the show. I always want people who've, you know, lived what they talk about. And you certainly have done that and are still doing that. I want to just start off by sharing some of your journey. And you said that you lived by the rules, by the book for so long. Yeah. Where were you? What happened?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of my favorite expressions is that a discontent is the first step in progress or change in your life, and that many of us wouldn't change if we didn't try, and we wouldn't try if we weren't forced to. And that was totally true with me and my experience. I grew up in one of the most loving, sort of supportive families you could ever dream of, and I had two very, very loving parents. My dad was a disciplinarian. My mom was a bit of a caretaker, and she didn't work. But as I grew up, I had very, very high expectations, and I think that was a good thing in an objective way, because I became a very good student. I was a great athlete, and I seemed to have friends and things. But I had this sort of growing sense of pessimism on the inside, and nothing ever sort of seemed to be good enough in my life. And that eventually, that sense of pessimism grew, and I eventually became more and more cynical and more dysphoric. And I got to a place in my life where I was deeply, deeply depressed. And that place in my life probably lasted for a couple of years. And it got so bad at one point that I was very seriously considering and contemplating suicide on a daily basis. During that period of time, I went online. I was looking and trying to figure out what way I would go about killing myself. Would I slash my wrist? Would I shoot myself? Would I, try to take, so many drugs or pills that I would just kill, I'd die? I mean, it was very, sort of very, very deep and dark and sort of dramatic. And it was interesting because at the same period of time when I was going through this, I had this sense of peace at one moment that kind of washed over me. It was something about contemplating suicide that sort of gave me a second shot at life. And it sounds a bit like a cliche, but it's totally what happened to me. I sort of realized that there was some kind of connection between what I was thinking and how I was feeling. And so I said, oh, I can put off suicide for another day or another week or even another month. Let me look more closely at why it is I felt this sudden sense of sort of peace as I was contemplating suicide. And as I began doing that, that's when I went back to get the master's degree in positive psychology. And I did a lot of reading and a lot of soul searching.
Well, tell me, and I don't mean to make light of this at all, mm-hmm. but you're such a good-looking guy. When people looked at you, they just thought, this guy has everything going for him. And it just goes to show what goes on in the inside of people, doesn't it?
That's a good point. It's so, first of all, sweet of you to say that. I've never felt that way about myself, Vicki. And I've had people say that. And I've even had, a career in modeling and entertainment. And I worked as an actor and everything. And but I never really saw myself that way. And so despite it being so good on the outside, and I hear what you're saying, despite it being so good on the outside, and despite what other people sort of believed and perceived about me, I didn't feel any better for it on the inside. And that's huge, because most of us sort of look at celebrities and look at folks that are really good looking or very intelligent or have lots of money, will say, that person has to be happy. They have a fantastic life. How could they not be? But you never know what's going on behind closed doors, and you can never really walk in another person's moccasins.
Absolutely.
And so, there's something to be said for experiencing something yourself, and it has a lot less to do probably with the circumstances and conditions of your life and a lot more to do with what's going on the inside.
Yeah, and I would think having gone through that experience, Robert, it gives you a much better perspective to help other people when you're coaching them.
Absolutely. absolutely. That's such a poignant statement that you make there, Vicky, because that is 100% true. Because whereas before, you know, I think before I sort of had that experience, I just sort of assumed that, you know, if a person had a pretty good life, that they'd be happy, or that if I could find a way, if people could find a way to line up circumstances in a way, meaning get enough money or just get the right relationships sort of lined up or have perfect health, that they'd also have, you know, a very happy existence too. And through my experience, I realized that's totally not true. You can have a fantastic life on the outside from everybody else's perspective, but just be miserable on the inside.
Yeah. Now, you said, you just mentioned you went back to school and you took positive psychology. Many of our listeners might already know this, but I don't. Tell me what positive psychology means.
Yeah, positive psychology is a brand new science, only about 8 years old, and it's basically the study and science of what makes life worth living. It's the study and science of happiness. And people say, oh, well, that's obvious. Isn't that what psychology has always been about? And interestingly enough, the answer is no. Most psychology was really focused on studying mental dysfunction, abnormality, and what was wrong with people. And you can never figure out what's right with people by only studying what's wrong with them. By only focusing on the problem, you'll never come up with a solution. And that's often what we found, you know, through hundreds of years of psychology study, is that you can study depression all you want, but it won't tell you how to make a happy, healthy, functioning individual. It will just teach you how to basically get rid of the problems. But, you know, getting rid of the problems doesn't make for a complete person. It just makes for an empty one.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you began your career in modeling. You made guest appearances on television shows for MTV, NBC, CBS. You were an actor. What made you make that switch from acting, from modeling, to doing what you're doing now?
You know, I think it's interesting. The one thread I think that's always been woven throughout my life has been a real focus and sort of an appreciation and passion for understanding people and what motivates them and what inspires them and why they do the things they do. And so over the course of my life, you know, I've had so many jobs because I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And even though that thread seems so obvious now, that thread of, you know, psychology and helping people seems so clear now, it wasn't always. And so I worked as a corporate consultant for a while, and then I was laid off. And I thought that was going to be one of the worst experiences of my life. It actually turned out to be one of the best and most rewarding because, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you if I hadn't been laid off. But in the meantime, after being laid off, a model agent approached me on the street in Miami Beach and said, hey, you should stop by the agency. I don't know about that. And then I ran into another agent. They said, you should really stop by this other agency. And I said, okay, fine. Maybe the universe is trying to send me a sign of some sort. So I went into the agency and I just started modeling and acting. And it wasn't anything I had set out to do. It was just me sort of trying to figure out what it was I wanted to do with my life. And I noticed that I loved sort of expressing my ways myself in creative ways. And so it was just sort of a step along the path to me becoming a coach. But the whole time, I was still very, very serious about, you know, my self-help reading, the psychology reading that I did, a lot of the spirituality reading. And so the thread was there, and it seems so obvious now, but at that time, it really wasn't.
Yeah, and you kind of brushed past that you were a consultant, but you were actually a consultant with one of the largest, most successful companies in the world.
Yeah. They're a Big Five consulting firm, Deloitte and Touche. I love them still. And I worked there as an executive coach. So I was sort of helping executives find ways to maximize profit or find ways to improve their communication skills and things like that. And so it was a great stepping stone and a great thing to put on my resume and everything. But at the end of the day, I'm sort of happy that that I got laid off, interestingly enough, because it allowed me to get clear about what I really wanted to do. But yeah, Deloitte is a fantastic company.
Mm. So you had moved to Miami, and is that where you went to school in Miami?
I went to get my undergraduate degree at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, a very small liberal arts school. And then I did do a short stint at University of Miami to get my business degree, part and parcel of the process of me trying to figure out what I really wanted to do. And then from there, I moved on and got my master's of applied positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, again in Philadelphia.
Mm. What was the significance in moving to Miami for you?
You know, I was in a place in my life, Vicky, where I'd gone through this very serious sort of deep, dark depression, and I was trying to pull myself up out of this hole that I sort of dug for myself emotionally. And I knew, I didn't know much, you know, I didn't know exactly what I was doing. All I knew is that what I was doing before wasn't working so well. And as they say, if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting you'll keep getting what you've always gotten. And so I said, you know, I'm not loving being in Philadelphia so much anymore. It's a great city, but maybe not a good fit for me. So I said, I don't know much. I don't know what I want to do for a career. I don't know how to necessarily get myself out of this emotional hole that I've dug. But I do know that I want to live somewhere that where it's sunny. I want to change my scenery and my environment a little bit. I want to meet new people. And I want to do some things that I haven't done before. And I had taken a vacation to Miami, and I loved it. And I thought, well, I can always move back to Philadelphia. It doesn't work out. Why don't I give it a shot? And so I moved down to Miami. I guess it's been about 8 years or so now, or maybe a little bit less than that. But it was a great move for me. Just really good fit for my personality at the time.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll start looking at some of the information you have to share with us today, because I know that 12 years of research and 12 years of practice has gone into putting this together, and you have some great solutions. Yeah. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Robert Mack, and we're talking about happiness from the inside out, the art and science of fulfillment.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk podcast reviews brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk podcasts today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Feed your mind and your body and spirit will follow. Alternative Talk 1150.
Don't worry. Be happy.
Okay, I'm gonna play that musical day to myself today because I was worrying all weekend about something so stupid I can't even believe I gave it the time of day. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest is Robert Mack. 12 years of research and 12 years of practice went into the work that we're talking about today. Happiness from the Inside Out is his book, The Art and Science of Fulfillment. And he has, we're talking about the science of happiness here and the art. So I wonder if we could just talk a little bit, Robert, about what you mean by the science of happiness versus the art of happiness.
Sure. I think that's a fantastic question. You know, one of the things that you and I were discussing a little earlier is that, you know, the science of happiness is relatively new, only about 8 years old, born out of the laboratory. Laboratories of University of Pennsylvania and Harvard and the Ivy Leagues, but also born out of places like Claremont Graduate University in California. But basically, the science of happiness, what we mean by that, is that people have studied for the last 8 years or so what leads to a happy life and what doesn't lead to a happy life. So does marriage lead to a happy life? Does age affect happiness? How about money? And if so, how much money? How about health? And by and large, what scientists have been able to say is these things tend to lead to happiness and these things tend not to lead to happiness. So that's really what the science is about, is like what kinds of things and circumstances and conditions will make for a happy life and which ones won't. And of course, when you're talking about science, you're just saying sort of what statistically is true for most people. So that doesn't tell you what's necessarily right for Vicky or what's necessarily right for Rob or for anybody individually. It just tells us what's generally true. And so one thing that people have to keep in mind is that happiness is also an art. It's something that you custom tailor and you custom fit for your own life. And so as you think about the principles that we'll discuss a little later, you've got to keep in mind that if something doesn't work for you, then maybe it's not right for you. And so you've got to judge a tree by its fruit and, you know, try to do something different and change your strategy sort of accordingly.
Yeah. Now, you do base most of the book around the 8 principles of happiness, which have been empirically proven, scientifically validated. Before we get into that, I want to just talk about this a little, because you say in the book, pursuit for success is actually a thinly veiled pursuit of unhappiness, which sounds very as though it's contradicting itself. Explain that to us.
Yeah, you know, many of us sort of pursue success, you know, very vigilantly, and we want to line up our lives, and there's nothing wrong with this. We want to get our lives to a place where it's almost perfect. We say, well, if we can just have X number of dollars, and we can have this kind of spouse and this kind of partner, and we can have this kind of health and these kinds of kids, and we can retire at this specific age, then we'll have a happy life. And what happens is that as you pursue, you know, this condition or that condition or this circumstance, what you're really saying is you're really trying to manufacture or synthesize the happiness out of the conditions of your life. And what happens is the more that you chase those things, those sort of material or financial sort of status symbols to a large extent, or you chase this perfect life and you don't achieve it, the more unhappy you become in the process. And as you become more unhappy, you chase those things even more vigilantly. And then, of course, you don't reach them quite the way that you thought you would. Or when you do achieve them, you realize that they're replaced by something else. Your brand new satisfied desire is nothing more than a launching pad for brand new unsatisfied desire. And so it's kind of like this revolving door of desire. One desire replaces the next. And so as you do that, as you chase success in one form or another, what you don't realize is that it's really a pursuit of unhappiness, because every time you reach that new place or that new partner or have that new amount of money, you just want more and more and more. And so it becomes this horrible sort of downward emotional spiral of negativity in a way. And most of us don't realize that. But if you look at your life, you'll find that that often many of us are living proof of the frustration that comes with trying to create a perfect life.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the two myths of happiness. You say there are two big myths that we buy into. What are they?
Yeah, that's a great segue too, because to a large extent, when we're talking about sort of the pursuit, quote unquote, of unhappiness, what we're really talking about is there's an assumption built in that happiness is like success, that if you can only find a way to get everything that you want, that you'll be happy. If you can only find a way to create a perfect life, you'll be happy. But the truth is that you have to find a way to be happy before you can create that perfect life. Because if you wait your entire life for your life to be perfect, you'll wait the same amount of time to be happy. Realize that happiness is not something from creating a perfect life. Every subject in your life is really two subjects. It's the pro and the con, the advantage and the disadvantage. There are negative and positive aspects to everything and everybody. And so don't wait for your life to be perfect before you're happy. If you do, you'll wait an entire lifetime.
Yeah, and you do talk about law of attraction, which many people do now, and you say that must begin with happiness.
Yeah, that's I love that, Vicky. You know, one of the things I'm very passionate about is that, you know, I watched The Secret. I thought it was fantastic. I read Abraham Hicks and a lot of those folks that were pioneers in discussing law of attraction in the current form that was discussed in today. And what some folks have sort of told me about my book, they said, Rob, your book, interestingly enough, is kind of like the science, in a way, behind the law of attraction, the law of allowing. And it is, meaning that, by and large, science has found that the most successful people in the world, those people that have the best relationships, that make the most money, that do the best from a professional standpoint, and those people, by and large, are happy first. So happiness ironically enough, leads to a successful life. It leads to successful life outcomes. And what that means is you've got to find a way to be happy without all those things you think you want. And in getting happy, well, that's the point of it anyway, but in getting happy, you also will tend to attract those or manifest those successful life outcomes in your life as well. And so I just think that's so beautiful about happiness and about sort of success and the science of success and happiness.
Yeah. Now, what about for somebody who's listening and they go, well, you know, I was born a pessimist and that's the way I am. You say that's not necessarily true. We can change. We can learn optimism.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. There's a grain of truth to what they're saying there, which is basically that part of pessimism and optimism and happiness and unhappiness is genetic, right? So it's inherited to a certain extent.
Right.
But becoming happier is not like becoming taller. You can always become happier. And most of us live in what I would call the lower decks of our happiness range. We all sort of have a range. And most of us do a lot of things that don't necessarily lead to a happier life. And you can always become happier. And so it's very important, as you said, to realize that optimism is something that can be learned from a scientific perspective. It's something that you can teach yourself. There are fantastic books that you can read. Happiness from the Inside Out is a great one. Learned Optimism is a fantastic book. But there are all kinds of books that will help teach you how to become more of an optimistic. And it's just a question of learning how to focus properly.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a look at the eight principles. And the first principle is the principle of smart energy investments.
Yeah. It's incredible how much time a lot of us spend on really low value activities, and then likewise how much time and sort of how little time we spend on high value activities. Meaning, if you look at even like your closet, if you go to a closet and just check out how much of your wardrobe you actually wear on a daily basis. For
right.
me, I've noticed it's like very few things. Like I wear the same 3-4 shirts like over and over again, and it's ridiculous that I have this decent sized wardrobe, but I wear very few of the things over and over again, and so. You want to apply that principle to your happiness and success as well. So when you think about happiness, think about those things that really bring you a lot of happiness or a lot of joy or a lot of well-being without you putting a ton of effort or energy or money into it. And those are the things that you want to do more of, right? Those are the activities you want to pay more attention to and focus more money, time, and energy into. And likewise, there are some things that you just kill yourself and knock yourself out doing that don't bring you a whole lot of joy, they don't bring you a whole lot of success, and they don't bring you a whole lot of return or rewards. And so you want to, as much as possible, reduce or delegate or eliminate those activities. And it's not always easy, and sometimes you can't do that. But as long as you lean in the direction of things that feel better and lean away from the things that don't feel necessarily very good and that you're spending inordinate amounts of time pursuing, your life will inevitably get better. It's impossible for it not to.
Yeah, and I think, and you do talk about this in the book too, we don't have to do everything overnight. I mean, it's gradually noticing, it's gradually changing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer that, you know, the 1,000-mile journey begins with one step. You know, you're just one foot in front of the other. And so just do what's in front of you, and you'll notice there are some things in your life that don't give you a very high payoff and aren't very rewarding emotionally. And just do less of those things, and you'd be surprised some of the things that you can eliminate in your life if you just take it slowly and just start with, you know, one step at a time.
Right. Principle number two, very popular in Eastern philosophies, the principle of non-attachment.
Yeah, that's a big one. And the one thing I am very careful to remind people of is that when we're talking about not attaching, I don't necessarily mean not to have big dreams or big goals or to be ambitious. No, be ambitious, have big dreams, have big goals. I certainly do. But what it means finding a way to detach how you feel from those circumstances or conditions, because some of us say, well, we'll be happy when we retire. We'll be happy when we make a certain amount of money. We'll be happy when our dreams come true. But if you do that, you'll wait a very long time.
Mm.
And so you have to remember that most of your life is spent, you know, climbing up the hill. Most of your life is spent on your way toward your goal. It's not actually spent, you know, on stage giving your thank you speech at the Oscars or the Grammys. One of the things I've been lucky and blessed to have in my life is that, you know, I have a lot of clients that are very, very successful, and they'll tell you over and over again, wow, Rob, I thought that when I got the Oscars or the Grammys or whatnot, that it would be this incredible moment, and it was this incredible moment, but I realized I spent 99% of my life on my way towards that stage and not actually on the stage, and if I hadn't enjoyed it along the way, I would have wasted much of my life.
Yeah, such an important point there, such an important point.
Yeah.
Principle number three, the principle of positive focus.
Yeah, you know, we sort of live in an age of distraction, and
much
of our life, we really do. And you know, and I'm a case in point. You know, it's like one thing has my attention one day or for one moment, and then somebody else calls, and suddenly my attention or my focus has shifted completely. And so, one of the things that I've become a lot more cognizant of is to notice how I feel when I pay attention to certain things. So for me, sometimes watching TV isn't the best feeling activity I could do on a specific day, or sometimes certain conversations don't make me feel particularly good. And it seems so obvious to say, well, if the stove is hot, just stop touching it. If that hurts when you do it, just stop doing it. But some of us forget that. And so the one thing that positive focus is about is realizing that if it doesn't feel good to pay attention to this or to that, stop paying attention to this or that. Pay attention to things that do feel good. Find something to appreciate. Find reasons to feel good and cast your gaze to the sunny side of the sidewalk.
Right. And that help, you know, also applies to people we hang out with, doesn't it? Because, you know,
I was
thinking I had company coming in and I love the one person to death. The other person, we just don't connect. We don't click. And I really didn't want them in my home.
And that's such a great one. I think people struggle with that one a lot. I know that I do, because you want to be a good person,
yeah,
and you want the other people to think of you as good people. And you know that too, down deep, they're probably very well-meaning, well-intentioned people. But the point is that you want the purpose of a relationship, the purpose of a friendship, is to enhance everybody's sort of what we call subjective well-being, but to make everybody better off and happier. And if you notice in a conversation that you're not enjoying the conversation or you're not enjoying somebody's company, it doesn't have to be about blame. There doesn't have to be anything wrong with that person. It just may be about chemistry or may not be a good fit. And so there's nothing wrong with finding a way to spend less time with that person and to find other activities to pursue that bring you a lot more happiness and joy. And that's such a great point. People really struggle with that one, but they have to let themselves off the hook a little bit and say, listen, maybe it's not their fault. Maybe it's not my fault. It's just something here that's not working out very well. So let me try something that does work better.
Yeah, good point. Principle number four, self-appreciation. This is hard for people to do, because I think of all the complaints I hear when I'm talking with listeners or working on other projects, is that that inner critic that people always have and deal with most of their lives. And even though we may know what to do with it, it's very hard to be consistent about keeping it in the background.
Yeah, I mean, and that's an issue that's been studied by psychologists forever. It's like this ego and the superego and all that. But basically, the idea is that most of us are our own worst critics. I know I certainly am. But what you've got to realize is that, you know, there's nothing wrong with personal growth. There's nothing wrong with self-help. There's nothing wrong with learning things. But realize that you will never be perfect. You will never be complete in your life. And while you may make that a target or an aim to become the best person you can, if you continue living that way where you are always expecting to be perfect or hoping to be perfect, you'll live a very miserable life. And the only reason you want to be perfect, or that you want to have things work out for you, or the only reason you want to be smart or intelligent or good-looking or dress well or any of those things, is because you're after a feeling. And if you can get that feeling without necessarily having to go through all the torture and the sacrifice to get there, well, that's a really, really good thing, right? We're talking about doing it authentically, right? Because if we're not talking about popping a pill necessarily or any of those things, because in the long run, those things don't bring happiness either. So we're talking about finding a way to realize that it's the feeling you're really after as you begin to pursue whatever activity you're pursuing, whether it's professional or personal, and then to redefine success in terms of the joy you feel, redefine your life in terms of how things feel, and you can begin to find a way to appreciate yourself more by just making lists. A list of things that you appreciate. It doesn't have to be a very difficult chore. You just make a list and say, wow, you know, I may not be I might not be the most beautiful person in the world, but I certainly do appreciate my ability to be patient. I appreciate how tolerant I am. I appreciate how hard I work. I appreciate the family that I have. But you find things to appreciate, and the more you can focus that on yourself, the better you'll feel about yourself and the better life you'll have too.
Yeah, the better all around. And, you know, for everybody listening out there, you deserve to appreciate yourselves. So I hope we all do.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's such a huge, and there's one principle that I love, I think, the most. It's that one, because most of us feel like we have to prove ourselves or prove our worthiness. But the fact that you're born alone means that you're worthy. By the fact that, that you're living at all means that you're worthy of living a good life, and you deserve to live a good life. And if you're not living a good life, it's not because there's anything wrong with you necessarily. You may just not be taking a strategy or approach that's working very well. And so, you know, let yourself off the hook and realize that if you can find a way to appreciate yourself, your life will get better. I promise.
Yeah. You say tell yourself a better story. If you know, because we tend to repeat the same old story to ourselves. And principle number five is the principle of appreciative thought and language. How do we tell ourselves a better story?
Yeah, it's we make a great point there, Vicky, that most of us focus on what's not going right in our life, and that's a really sort of bad way to live because you become unhappy in it. But if you realize that, you know, you can't be unhappy in your life without an unhappy story, that every experience you have, every relationship you have, you're basically telling yourself stuff about that particular relationship or that experience in your head over and over again. And if you can notice how much self-talk goes into any particular experience, you'll notice that there's an emotional effect from that self-talk. And so one of the things that I really encourage people, and it's really just about learning to be more optimistic, but I tell people, listen, look for a way to explain what's happening in your life in a way that feels better, but do it based on truth. So for me, for instance, I got laid off, and I thought it was the most horrible thing in the world. And so at first, the best feeling story I could tell myself was, well, I guess it's good because I had some time off and some free time, even though I'm not making money. But I kept working on that story and still basing it in truth. And I said, wow, this is a really good thing because I didn't love that job anyway. I want to write a book. There are some things I want to share with other people. I'm living in Miami now. Maybe I can find a job that doesn't require me to travel so much. And this is really a stepping stone to something much bigger and better. And as you begin telling that better feeling story, you'll feel better. And as you feel better, you'll do better as well. That's what science tells us. That's what my life experience has told me. And that's what a lot of my clients have found as well. And so just find a way to describe things in your life so that they feel better to you.
Yeah, and that works very closely with principle number six, which is the principle of constructive response to adversity. My mother was forever telling me as a child, adversity strengthens the character. Didn't fully appreciate it then, but it certainly does.
So I love that one. I love the way your mom put that so eloquently.
Yeah, I think she read it from a book. But it was all good information. But you say look for the advantages to be found, and you just talked about that a little in reassessing your story.
Here's the most beautiful thing I think about adversity, is that adversity, and what I call contrast sometimes because it makes me feel better about it, but anytime you experience adversity or contrast in your life, what's really going on there is that you're getting clear about what you really want. Without, you know, it's like this, it's the sour that allows the sweet to be that much sweeter, and so you've got to really find a way, and it's not an easy thing, but it's something that with practice you'll get better at. Find a way to embrace and appreciate the adversity in your life, because it's the adversity that lets you slow down, take stock of your life, and reprioritize what's truly important. See, a lot of us get caught up in a busy life, or we get caught up in pursuing success and being ambitious. There's nothing wrong with any of that, but sometimes we sort of pursue the wrong things, and it's really important. You know, I think that sort of one of my suggestions sort of for myself that I remind myself of and to my clients sometimes is to proceed slowly, because direction is so much more important than speed. If you're running 100 miles an hour and you're going in the wrong direction, that's a major problem. So, I think people, the more that you can find a way to make peace with what's going on in your life and find a way to be happy despite things not being perfect, as you begin to feel better, your life will take on a better feeling flavor, and before long, the situations and conditions will begin to change as well.
Yeah, and that's such a good point about, you know, thinking what we're doing before we start that 100-mile run, because so many companies today force us into that situation to be productive when it's not always necessarily constructive.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's like, and I remember being at work, and you know, this is not a knock against any particular company, but I remember being at work and feeling very much like I needed to, even if I didn't have work, I needed to make sure that people thought that I was, busy and productive and creative, and so I would do everything in my power to make sure I looked busy, even if I necessarily wasn't. And it's sort of funny, but I think that it's something, it's a trap that people can get caught up in, but it's easy to remove yourself from that trap and realize that the point of all of it is just to feel good, and it's not necessarily to go running 100,000 miles per hour in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Number seven is the principle of inspired action, and I love this because I'm big on, you mentioned The Secret earlier, and I think the ingredient that's missing from that for me is you still have to take action. Yes, I hear the law of attraction and all that. You still have to take action. But you talk about taking inspired action.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point that you make, sort of about The Secret. I love The Secret, and I think that it's made even better when you bring up something like the inspired action, because most of us, and I certainly am a case in point, act from a place of fear, or we'll act from a place of obligation, or we'll act from a very negative place where we feel like we have to do. But one of the best things, and something that I love about the Abraham Hicks folks that we mentioned before, is that they make this recommendation too, that you want to pre-pave your action journey with an emotional journey, and to take that emotional journey first, meaning find a way to reach for a positive feeling before you take action. Look for a way to be inspired before you take action, and realize that if you can get yourself an emotional place where you're excited about what's coming next, and you're focusing on the positive, and you're doing some of the other things that we mentioned earlier in the book by telling yourself a better feeling story, and really pre-paving your next experience, you'll find that the action will be inspired naturally, effortlessly, and seamlessly from this positive, sort of empowered, uplifting place, and it won't feel like such hard work. And so that's when people talk to me and say, "What should I do as far as work?" And I know that I should work hard. And I say, "Well, it shouldn't feel like hard work. If it feels like hard work, you're probably going about it in the wrong way. It should feel more like play. And that doesn't mean that it will always feel like play, but it should be more about being in the flow and being in the zone. And it should be more playful and find a way to make it fun. And so one of the things that you can do is begin to apply the other principles, you'll notice that you'll be inspired and excited and enthusiastic about going to work, or excited and enthusiastic about, you know, having that conversation with a loved one that you need to have, or you know, making a new investment. But it'll come from a much more positive, sort of thrilling place than it will from a, like, begrudgingly, you know, sort of dysphoric and fearful place. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, and I'm actually reading Sir Richard Branson's book right now, you know, The Virgin Leader, and he talks about play too, very important. And last but not least, principle number 8, self-empowerment in relationships.
Wow. Yeah, it's interesting because the science of happiness, you know, and positive psychology, which is also about more than that, it's also about character strength and virtue and all that, also speaks about the importance of relationships. Relationships are really, really critical. And what they found is that marriage, and this is going to surprise people, I think, is that married people tend to be happier. But the reason that they're happier is because they're happier before they get married. And so two happy individuals obviously would make for a happy, you know, healthy marriage. And so one of the things that you can begin to do, though, is realize that if you want to have a happy relationship, and if you want to have of any sort, whether it's a business relationship, whether it's a personal relationship, a romantic one, the most important thing you can do is find a way to be happy. Because you can't. The worst thing you can do is go into a relationship hoping that the other person will complete you or the other person will make you happy. That will never happen. Unhappiness only breeds more unhappiness. And so what you really want to do is find a way to make peace with where you are and begin telling that better feeling story. Find things that are positive to focus on. Find a way to detach from circumstances and conditions and realize that happiness is ultimately up to you. It's just a question of finding things that feel good. And so if you can do that one thing, you'll find that you'll begin to entertain much more empowered, healthy, functioning relationships, and that's really what you're after anyway. It's not you don't want a relationship or a marriage just to have a relationship or in the marriage. It's because those things you hope will give you a better feeling and make you happier. And so the way to start doing that is just start with happiness.
Yeah, and I love this in the book, and I wish I had learned this 20 years ago.
Me too.
I could have saved myself a lot of grief. You say in the book, you can't get unhappy enough to help a depressed spouse or friend.
And I've tried.
I think we all have.
I've tried over and over again. And that's something you think, wow, I should have learned that the first, you know, 3 years. But no, I try. And we do have this sort of unconscious assumption that we can buy somebody else happiness, or we can buy ourselves happiness if we only store up enough unhappiness, that somehow if we can torture ourselves enough on the way to happiness or sacrifice enough. But the truth is that there is no happy ending to an unhappy journey, and it's all really about the journey. And so find a way to be happy now. Find a way to make happiness and your happiness depend on you. Your happiness is your job. My happiness is my job. And leave everybody else's happiness up to them. That doesn't mean that you won't do nice things for people. But in fact, quite the contrary, the happiest people also tend to be the most charitable and generous. And so the happier you get, the more happiness you'll give to, you'll be able to share with other people. So if there's one, I think if there's one principle, in addition to self-appreciation, that I'd really like to remind myself of, and that I think people will find incredibly invaluable, it's that one.
Yeah. Robert Mack, you've been a delight to talk to you today. What would you like to leave our listeners with?
Oh, my goodness. I love your show, Vicki. I love you, and I really appreciate being on the show. Thank you. And if folks are interested in learning more about Happiness from the Inside Out, you can always check out www.happinessfromtheinsideout.com. You can pick up the book at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and all of your independent favorite local bookstores.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Robert Mack. And again, Robert's book is called Happiness from the Inside Out, The Art and Science of Fulfillment by Robert Mack. And I can understand now why he got such great reviews from people. The book itself, I mean, we touched on a fraction of it. And I think Robert shared some great information with us today. We'll be right back with author Carol Zelaya. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Makes us...
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Thanks to its listeners, Alternative Talk 1150 has become the most refreshing talk radio in our area. Now we want to hear more from you. Log on to 1150kknw.com and take a brief survey. Besides helping improve your favorite station, you'll have a chance to win an overnight trip to Victoria, BC, courtesy of the Victoria Clipper. Log on now to 1150kknw.com to be heard and to have a chance at winning. Contest details posted online.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150. Join Vicki Monday, July 13th for our Daily Meds, a must-hear investigation of the pharmaceutical industry's aggressive promotional practices. Learn how its control of prescription drug information buries critical information from even the savviest consumers and physicians, and why researchers say that one American dies every 5 minutes from prescription drugs taken as directed. Don't miss our Daily Meds coming Monday, July 13th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3, Alternative Talk 1150.
Once there lived a chicken who would say chick, 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 chick all day. Soon that chick got sick and tired of just chick, chick. So one morning he started to say, chickery chick, chala chala, chickalaroni in a banana, kabalaka walaka, can't you see?
All right, Eric, you have to tell us. Welcome back, everyone. We're going to talk about a series of books in a moment called Emily the Chickadee. Where did you find that music, Eric?
Well, that's Sammy Kaye.
Oh, well, you say that like
chickery
I should know.
Chick.
I don't know if our guests could hear that, but let me introduce her and we'll bring her on. Her name is Carol Zelaya, and her love of nature and its gifts led her to author a series of illustrated children's books. She lives in Portland, Oregon, and joins us today to share her journey and the stories of Emily the Chickadee. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I don't think you could hear the music Eric was playing, could you?
I did. It was funny.
I know. He finds these little gems, you know. He tries to tie them into the show. No, it always makes me laugh. I like it. It's fun. It's good fun. Well, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you have a passion for traveling, writing, nature, and you managed to combine two of your passions in writing these three children's books. Now, tell us, did you... First of all, they're called Emily the Chickadee. I should say that. Emily the Chickadee. And the first book, I think, is Caring for Emily's Family.
First book is Emily Waits for Her Family.
Oh, right. I got them back to front. I'll let you tell us which order they go in. They got all mixed up here.
That's okay.
So Emily Waits for Her Family. And it's a true story, it says, by you. Tell us a little bit about the book and how it came about.
Well, I was just amazed by this little chickadee that I could look out and watch what she was doing from my window. And I would even go outside with my little dogs, and she was nesting in my flower box and my flower pots on my deck. When she did it the first time, I just thought, oh, how cute, you know, that's really sweet. And then I think she trusted that it was a safe place for her because she did it again. And I started to tell people about this, and they said, this really isn't normal chickadee behavior. They're more cavity dwellers. They like to dwell more in a birdhouse or a niche of a log or up in a eave of a gutter, somewhere very protected, not just out in the open. So I knew I had a very special chickadee, and I just decided one day to see if I was so amazed by what she was doing, and if I was learning so much simply by watching her every day, I was thinking maybe I can, you know, write this as a children's story and teach children what I'm learning from just from observing this bird. So the first book, Emily Waits for Her Family, is this more or less the springtime book when the bird, you know, comes and nests and lays her eggs and waits for them to hatch, and then observing the mother bird feeding the, you know, her chicks until they're old enough to fly away. So it's basically everything that you can find. In my case, it was right outside my window. It could be on your deck, in your own backyard. You don't have to drive to a faraway place to observe nature. So, and then I thought, okay, what would the second book be? And I thought, okay, well now, you know, how are the children going to learn how to take care of the birds? So to keep them in their yard. Otherwise, they'll fly away and find food somewhere else. So the second book, Caring for Emily's Family, teaches children how to put out things, simple things like bird seed, water, maybe a birdhouse, a bird bath. You know, that's really fun to watch the bird splash in the bird bath. So that really was the second book. And then the third book, because this is a true story, it took a few years to write the third book because I just didn't know what was going to happen. I was in the process. Right. I mean, you know, I had to get inspired by a chickadee, you know, to write the third book. And so we were in the process of building a home out in the country, more of a rural area, but still, you know, right outside of Portland. It's actually in Oregon City. And it was the following spring after we moved into the new house that my husband opened the front door, and he said, he called me there, and he says, you have to see this. You're not going to believe it. And I had a nest in the artificial reef on my front door, and it ended up being a chickadee nest. And that was all the inspiration I needed. I sat down and I wrote the third book. And in the third book, the little girl, because it's told from the perspective of a little girl. And the little girl is sad because she has to move and she wonders if she'll ever see Emily again. She's going to miss her yard and everything. And the following spring, she becomes very happy and excited at the sight of another chickadee nest. So people always ask me, now, how can you prove that this is the same bird that followed the little girl to the country? Well, obviously it's not. We all know better. But in a child's mind, that all chickadees look alike, and for sure that's Emily.
I love at the back of the book you've got a little record log so that little kids can look for chickadees and where was the chickadee? Did you see a chickadee hop?
Yeah, I was hoping that would encourage them to, you know, to get outside and look for the birds and you know, interact on some level by observing them and then, you know, writing in the log in the book. So that was my thinking. I've actually heard a friend told me she has a granddaughter that also, you know, got a set of the books, and she and her little friend were outside playing Emily the Chickadee, and what they did was they made a nest, and then they put, I have a chickadee toy that people can win for free in a contest. It's the Audubon stuffed backyard bird.
I know I was going to enter for it, but I thought I'd better not.
Yeah, well, so this child took the chickadee toy, put it on a nest that she made, and they were playing Emily the Chickadee. And I'm like, well, I never even thought of that. I was just thinking about the children observing the birds and feeding the birds, and but I never thought that they'd actually make a nest and play Emily the Chickadee. So it does have children outside and thinking about nature.
Now, I get asked this question a lot when we've discussed subjects like this. I get emails from teachers and librarians and parents, too. What age group and what age group are we looking at here?
This is what I'm learning has happened. People now read children's books to their very young children, even before 1 year of age. I mean, I have friends that are grandmothers now for the first time, and their daughters are reading the books to children like when they're 6 months old. I've even experienced this when I went to a book reading. It consisted of all infants. They were like, I'd say, up to 2 years old. I didn't even know if they knew what I was talking about, but mothers do bring their children to book readings, and they want them to be, you know, read to at an early age. So I'd say children you read to, and certainly children that can start reading on their own. What teachers like about my books is that because they're written in simple rhyme, it's a really good book for young readers, you know, first, second, third grade readers that are started that can read on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also been told the rhyme actually helps children learn to read by anticipating the next rhyming word. So certainly young readers, and I've even had grandmothers buy the books because they love the art. If you're an avid gardener, I had an artist do the illustrations who is also an avid gardener, and she painted these realistically detailed flowers that are in every book in the specific season that book story is being told. So, for instance, in the first book, the springtime book, she had all of the beautiful Northwest flowers that we would have in our own gardens and backyards in the spring. And then in the summer, she just put, you know, all of the summertime flowers we'd have out in our backyard. And the wintertime to the following spring, she did the same thing with the holly and the berries and everything. So people have bought the books for the art itself, which is
it's
awesome.
Yeah, it's beautifully illustrated. I think that when you buy books for children, I always look at the illustration.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of the driving factor for children's books because they're so visual.
Yeah,
and it's lovely and colorful, and I love that. Did you choose the artist? Did the publisher choose the artist?
I actually started my own publishing company to publish these books, Richly Publishing. And I initially had an artist out of Chicago, but it just wasn't, it wasn't a good depiction of a bird, and it wasn't the kind of flowers I was hoping, you know. And I was actually referred to this artist from a personal acquaintance of mine and said, this woman specializes in drawing birds and painting flowers.
Mm.
So it was just a natural fit, and I felt very blessed to find someone that did such a wonderful job on all three books.
Yeah, now you live in Portland. She too lives in the Northwest.
Yes,
I checked out
exactly.
The website there.
Yes, Portland area.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that you have learned that children learn to read more effectively if the words are rhyming.
Yeah.
But you didn't know that when you wrote this book, right?
Poetry. Like to write poetry. So it was just an easy transition for me to write children's books that rhymed.
Mm.
I don't know. I must have known in my mind that these books were going to be probably for younger children. And I just don't think there are enough books written nowadays that, you know, that have rhyme. Of course, you have Dr. Seuss, but when I was growing up, all the fairy tales and all, you know, all the nursery rhymes that, you know, are classics, we just don't seem to have very much of that anymore. So
no.
Sometimes I get criticism that my rhyme is you know, very basic.
Well, you are writing for babies, for children.
That's what I say, but there are some people that I guess don't realize that.
Yeah. Well, they're lovely books. They're really well made, really nicely put together.
Thank you.
I know that one teacher I was reading, what she wrote, she said it's suitable for grades K-1. And she chose the book because They talk about how to build relationships with the wild birds, with animals, and the illustrations are suited to primary grades. So I think they're beautiful books. And I know that you do work with hospitals and underprivileged children. You donate some of these books.
Yes.
So I'm going to donate the series that you sent to me to an underprivileged school for their library.
And if you get any response to this broadcast that we're doing, if there are any other needy people in the area, organizations, of course, that would like a set of books, please contact me and I'll mail it to them.
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful offer. So if you know of needy children, needy libraries that are underfunded, schools that are underfunded, you can contact Carol Zelaya. We are at the end of the show right now. But Carol, very quickly, could you give out your website so they know how to reach you?
Yes, it's www.emilythechickadee.com. And they can contact me. I can get my email if they post a note to me on my website.
Lovely. Thank you so much for being with us. And I wish
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I wish you all the best with these. They're delightful books. My guest again, Carol Zelaya. And the series of books is called Emily the Chickadee. There are three books in the series, but of course you can buy them individually. Or you can contact Carol if you'd like to have a set donated to an underprivileged library or school. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. Comments or feedback on today's show, or if you missed any of the contact information, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or info@conversationslive.net. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Join Vicky Monday, July 13th for our Daily Meds, a must-hear investigation of the pharmaceutical industry's aggressive promotional practices. Learn how its control of prescription drug information buries critical information from even the savviest consumers and physicians, and why researchers say that one American dies every 5 minutes from prescription drugs taken as directed. Don't miss our Daily Meds coming Monday, July 13th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Views expressed on the preceding program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KWJZ 98.9 FM, Digital HD3 Seattle.
Good afternoon, Eric Ryder here with you on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Time now for a look at our traffic. Southbound I-5 seeing some off and on scattered delays. Northgate Way on down to Roanoke. And 520 is backed up westbound now, or eastbound rather, Montlake Boulevard over to the western.